The ocean's tides, what forces create them? What's their impact on humanity? And how are they changing? You probably learned in science class that tides are caused by gravitational force exerted by the moon. And that's true, but it's not the whole story. Many forces affect tides, including wind, air pressure, water temperature, and the position of the sun. Humans have been striving to understand the tides for millennia, and their interpretations say a lot about culture, religion, and history. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we learn more about tides with the author of a new book. Jonathan White spent 20 years reading, interviewing, and traveling the globe in an effort to try and understand tides. His travels took him to the Bay of Fundy, of course, but also to China, Chile, and the coast of France. What have you always wondered about tides? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The ocean tides are a powerful and mysterious force that have affected and puzzled humans for thousands of years. Author Jonathan White joins the long list of people affected by tides, so much so that he spent 20 years of his life researching them. White's new book is Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean, and it's part scientific exploration, part travelogue. Jonathan joins me in the studio today, and as always, we want to hear from you. What questions have you always had about tides? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Jonathan, I have to say, I am really enjoying this book. It's you're a fantastic writer, and there's so much, you know, I thought living in Maine, I knew a lot about tides, and I'm learning that I really know very little. And so I love it when that happens. So, but I need to ask you, you spent 20 years working on this book. Why tides? What intrigued you so much about them that you've devoted a huge chunk of your life to them?
Well, I suppose the story starts that I grew up in the California coast, surfing and sailing and diving, and it seems like I always had a tide chart in my back pocket. And, of course, I knew how to read the tide chart very well because a lot of my activities were governed by the tides. But I didn't know how it worked, especially. And it wasn't until later, about my mid-20s, I bought a big old wooden schooner when I lived up in Seattle. And we started a nonprofit educational organization on that big old boat and sailed it up and down the coast from Seattle to Southeast Alaska, around Haida Gwaii, around Vancouver Island. And I almost lost that boat in a big Alaskan gale and tide. And after that point, I decided it's time to learn what's going on here, because I know the moon has something to do with it, but I wasn't sure. And that's when I dove in.
Well, we all do learn that the moon's gravitational force controls the tides, but there are other forces, aren't there? Tell me about some of them.
Oh, gosh, there are so many. And you know, one of the interesting things about this, and again, I had no idea I was going to dive so deeply into this. I thought that I would read an article or two and spend a couple of weeks and learn pretty much everything about the tide. But the more I read, the more complex and multi-layered and poetic it became. And so that 2 weeks and a couple of books quickly turned into 50, 100, then 300 books and 10, 20 years. So I dove in very deeply. So there are a lot of forces at work. It's not just the astronomy, what's happening up there, which is the relationship of the moon, sun, and Earth, but also what's happening down here, what we call fluid dynamics. And even that can be divided into two, what's happening in the deep ocean, and then what's happening once the tide crosses the continental shelf and gets into shallow water and starts to feel the bottom, as they say. The tide actually gets more and more complex the closer it gets into shore.
Hmm. So in the sun?
The sun is involved also, of course. It's the sun and the moon. The moon is the primary mover, but the sun is about 50% of the influence of the moon. So really it's all about whether the moon and the sun are working together to create the larger tides, or whether they're working at odds to one another and creating the smaller tides.
So when they're working together, I want you to pronounce the name of what that's called. S-Y-N-G-Y-Z-Y. What is
that's right.
How do you say it?
It's called syzygy. It's a great Scrabble word.
right. Yes. Apparently, it's a popular spelling bee word, too.
That's right.
Syzygy.
And it's a Greek word meaning yoked together. And it's basically alignment. So when we see the new moon or the full moon, it basically means that the moon, sun, and earth are aligned or in syzygy.
And that is called the spring tide. People in Maine know, anybody who lives near the coast of Maine knows to pay attention when the meteorologist on the television says it's going to be a spring tide. Everybody knows there are certain places that flood, including the parking lot here at Maine Public. Why is that such a large tide? Why is the spring? First of all, the spring tide has nothing to do with the season, does it?
That's right. It's a Anglo-Saxon word meaning to leap ahead. And then when the moon and the sun are at right angles to each other, when we see a quarter moon or a three-quarter moon, that's a neap tide, which is a lesser tide. And so when what's going on there when they're aligned is really just the moon and the sun working together to create the larger tides. And then, of course, we also know that the moon is sometimes closer to the earth and sometimes further away. So when it's closer, it's exerting a larger gravitational pull, and hence you have larger tides. We also circle the sun in an irregular pattern. So we're closer to the sun in January and further away from the sun in July. So if we're really close to the sun in January and we have a full moon and we have a moon that's closest to the earth, then we have the super tides.
A little about the history of tides. Even though human beings now understand more, maybe not everything, but more about tides and gravitational pull, people have been trying to figure this out forever. And I'm wondering if you can talk about some of the theories up until the 20th century.
Yes, you're exactly right. It really wasn't until the end of the scientific revolution in the 1700s that Newton and his colleagues gave us the laws of planetary motion and gravity so we could even get a finger hold on what was going on. So what I often say is for 99% of human history, we had no idea of the mechanism that caused the tides, but there was a lot of speculation.
What did people think?
Well, one of the thoughts was that the moon created the tides by heating rocks on the bottom of the ocean. And when those rocks were heated, it boiled the waters and made them expand, and that was high tide. And then when the moon went away, it cooled the rocks and the water contracted and cooled, and that was low tide. And a lot of people, of course, thought it was the breathing of the earth itself or a large beast.
I love that. I learned in your book that for a lot of millennia, in many cultures, people viewed the earth itself as a living organism.
That's right. That's right. And that the tides were the breathing of the earth. And Leonardo da Vinci was convinced it was the breathing of a large beast. And he tried to calculate the size of its lung. And where I live, up in the Haida Gwaii area, north of Seattle, the native Northwest Coast Indians believe that High Tide Woman made high tide by lifting her skirt.
In researching your book, you traveled to the Bay of Fundy. We have listeners from that region of Canada here at Maine Public Radio. What did you learn most about the Bay of Fundy that surprised you?
Oh gosh, there are so many things. It has a record tide of 54 feet 6 inches, which is 10 feet larger than the next largest tide in the world, and so it's an extraordinary tide and tide system there. And it shares that record, by the way, with Ungava Bay, which is about 1,300 miles north of the Bay of Fundy, just south of the Arctic Circle, and so there's a lot going on in the Bay of Fundy,
and a lot of people who've lived there for generations didn't think of it as a very ecologically important place, did they?
That's right. In fact, in that chapter, I spend a lot of time with a man named Peter Hicklin, who's a bird biologist. And we're basically tracking these very small birds, sandpipers, that fly from the Arctic all the way down to Suriname once a year, and they make one stop, and it's in the Bay of Fundy during the large tides in August. When the tide is out, it exposes these little tiny mud shrimp, and these birds feed on that, and they follow the tide line all the way down and all the way back up. And it's said that they eat as many as 16,000 of these little tiny mud shrimp in one tide cycle. And after 7 days of fattening up, they take to the air again and they fly nonstop down to Suriname. So it's a very interesting and intricate interrelationship between the tide, the birds, and the Bay of Fundy.
And it's only recently understood.
That's right. And in the 70s, they thought it was a moonscape, that there was no life in the intertidal zone. It was just all mud. And it really was in tracking these birds that exposed how much life there was actually in the intertidal zone.
Part of your book discusses the potential for generating power from energy by the tides. This is something that has long been discussed, especially in eastern Maine. Here in Maine, Copscook Bay was home to the first ever energy-generating ocean floor tidal turbine project. How significant was that project, the Ocean Renewable Power Company's project in Copscook Bay?
Very significant. And as you say, it was one of the first, and they've got some record for being one of the longest standing in the water and generating electricity. And I interviewed Chris Sauer in the book, and in fact, he was down in Chile with me at a conference down there to explore tide energy down in Chile, because they have tremendous tide resources down there and a real need to harness tide energy, but nothing in the water yet. What they're doing up there in Eastport is really important. And as you may know, there's also a tide testing site in the Bay of Fundy called Force, and another one I visited in the book in northern Scotland in the Orkney Islands, EMEC, which is the European Marine Energy Center. And it's one of the largest testing sites in the world. So there's a lot of interest in this. And in fact, ORPC also has units in the water up in Alaska, as you may know.
Why is tide power? Because I know the studies show it has great potential. Why has it not come further up to this point? It's more difficult than one would think, isn't it?
It is. I think that one of the stories I like to tell that illustrates this is the testing site in the Bay of Fundy is called Force. And about 6 years ago, the first unit went in the water there. And these are in-stream devices that go down underneath the water, and they look like propellers or windmills underneath the water. And this was a 60-foot diameter device that went down into the Bay of Fundy. And in 2 weeks, it crumpled. And the publicist told me there, well, the good news about that is there's a lot more power down there than we thought. And the bad news is we've got a ways to go to develop the technology that can withstand this kind of, condition. And I think that tells a lot there. The ocean environment is an extremely hostile environment for, salty, it's turbulent. Some people describe it like a hurricane underneath the water. And you can only work during certain times in current areas, right, during slack water. So you get all geared up. You've got your barges and your equipment and your people, and it's cost per minute. And you get out there during slack water so you can drop this thing, and then something goes wrong, a widget breaks or whatever, and then you call it off and you have to wait till the next tide. So it's there's a lot at stake there, but tremendous possibilities. And, of course, ORPC is one of the great organizations that's ahead of this game and proving that this is really a viable way to go.
We're talking with Jonathan White, the author of Tides, The Science and Spirit of the Ocean. If you have questions, our phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Jonathan, one thing you explore is the spiritual significance of tides in many cultures. And it's really interesting to me. You travel to a monastery, you travel to China, you travel the world, and you find that the power of tides on the human experience is universal, but the way in which people interpret the meaning is very different.
That's right. For example, I went down to Panama and visited the San Blas Islands on the east side of Panama, and that's a group of 350 islands that are inhabited by an indigenous group called the Kunayala. And they have a traditional belief that's still practiced today, that the tide is a spiritual visitor from another dimension that comes to check up on the village. And if it finds that everything is intact, it recedes like it normally would. But if not, it stays. So that they interpret sea level rise, you know, as a spiritual problem as well as a scientific one, because they know that if sea level rises, you know, 3 feet in the next 50 years, as it's conservatively estimated to do, that they're going to lose all their islands. But they do have a very spiritual view on it. And, of course, I went to Mont Saint-Michel in western France and the west coast of Normandy. And this is a monastery, a Benedictine monastery, that's been in existence since the 7th century. And it's completely tide wrapped. It's a 45-foot tide there. And a long, low flat. So when the tide is out, it's 10 miles away. And you can see it come in like a silver molten thread, and it gallops across these sand flats and wraps around the island. And these monks have lived and practiced there all this time. So I knew that there must be some relationship between this tidal phenomenon that happened daily there and their spiritual practice. So I did get an interview with them, and we spent some time together. It was remarkable. It was very moving, actually.
And you, I don't want to give it away, but you talk about that people used to make pilgrimages for religious reasons, but now they make their pilgrimage to see the tide, but the monks still tie that.
Yes. In the Middle Ages, people would walk for months to come to the monastery, Mont Saint-Michel. And, you know, it's interesting because in those days, walking for months like that had all kinds of dangers. But it was actually just the last half mile from the land out to the monastery that was the most dangerous, because they weren't familiar with the tides. And there's quicksand in those mudflats. So people were lost, just, and they could see salvation right there, right? So they would charge ahead and they would drown in the tides or lose themselves with the quicksand. So it's been a destination spot for pilgrimages for a long time. And when I talked to the monks there, they said tourists, because this is a World Heritage Site, so millions of people come to this place. And he said tourists come here. They don't realize they're pilgrims, but they are, because they see the monastery, but they have an experience of the tide. And when they have an experience of the tide, this phenomenon, it brings them closer to God. And actually, they're only a half step away from some kind of a revelation by being here. So they're pilgrims that don't know they're pilgrims.
Mm. Well, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions for Jonathan White. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Tidewater Motel, offering waterfront lodging and meeting facilities on Vinyl Haven Island. More at TidewaterMotel.com. And by Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at EvergreenYourHome.com.
On the next Fresh Air, the government's secret doomsday plans in case of nuclear attack. We talk with Garrett Graff, author of the new book Raven Rock, the story of the U.S. government's secret plan to save itself while the rest of us die. We'll also talk with him about Robert Mueller, the special counsel overseeing the Trump-Russia investigation. Mueller was the subject of Graff's previous book. Join us.
And you can hear Fresh Air this evening at 7 p.m. here on Maine Public Radio. Music That Moves Me continues all this month on both Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical, celebrating the power of music in a series of insightful and inspiring audio diaries. Continuing this year also is the Instrument Drive for aspiring young performers who would love to give new life to your neglected instrument. We are now accepting donated instruments at our Bangor, Lewiston, and Portland studios. To find out more about how you can participate or to hear any of the audio diaries, please visit mainpublic.org and click on radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Understanding the Role of Tides. With me in the studio, Jonathan White, who is a writer, conservationist, sailor, and educator. His new book is Tides, the science and spirit of the ocean. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We have a Robert on Twitter asking, a tweet from Robert saying, why do some seas have two tides daily while others have four?
You can't ask that question. It's a great question. So the general rule is that there are two tides a day. That's two lows and two highs. And that's because there's a bulge in the ocean that's directly underneath the moon. So let's just pretend for a moment that we're right here in Portland and the moon is directly overhead. And it's pulling a bulge of water. It's high tide directly underneath the moon, and we're standing here. Well, there's a bulge of water on the other side of the Earth, the opposite side of the moon, and that's caused by centrifugal force, which is the same kind of force that makes us want to spin out if we drive too fast around a curve. And it's centrifugal is a Greek word that means to flee. So there's another bulge over there. So imagine yourself now traveling as the Earth turns. We're going to travel all the way around to the opposite side of the Earth in 12 hours, right? And at that point, you'd be underneath another bulge, high tide. And then another 12 hours, you'd be back where you started. So in between that, you go through a valley, which is the low tide. So every 6 hours, roughly, You change, right, from high tide to low tide, high tide to low tide. So that being the general rule, there are places around the world that have one tide a day, like Tahiti, and there are places that have four tides a day, like Ireland, places in Ireland. And there are places like Biloxi and places in the Gulf of Mexico that today might have two tides a day and 2 weeks from now might have one tide a day. So it gets infinitely complex. And what you have to do to understand what's happening in any one of these places is unpack the modes that are at work there.
I think we have a related question from Jim in Georgetown. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks very much. So, Mr. Wright, I had the question that you just supposedly answered, that if the moon is primarily responsible for the tides and moon – well, the Earth rotates under the moon once every 25 hours approximately. Why are there two tides every 25 hours in most places? And I've read a number of explanations, none of which make sense. I don't think the centrifugal force explanation makes particular sense, because centrifugal force would be equal all the way around the globe. And two, if the centrifugal force is on the opposite side of the moon, the tide doesn't exactly track the moon around the Earth, right? The tide's a few hours behind.
That's so right.
You have a great graphic in your book that explains why the tides are not exactly every 24 hours. If you want to talk about that first and then maybe go back to Jim's first question.
Well, Jim's absolutely right that, you know, that it's because the moon is actually traveling along the same path as our own revolution with the Earth. By the time we come back, we make a full 24-hour circle. The moon has already traveled some distance in the same direction. So it takes us about 24 hours and 54 minutes to complete a lunar day, basically from one high tide to the next. So that's absolutely true. And the other thing is about the tide always being a little bit behind. That's also true, of course, and that's because the tide it rubs against the bottom of the ocean, and it can't, because of friction, it just cannot keep up with the motion of the moon. And there's a phenomenon called age of the tide. So when we see a full moon overhead, it really takes in this part of the world about a day and a half for us to see the largest tides that are influenced by that full moon. And there are places in the world that have, you know, age of the tide of 2 days, and some places that have 4 days, or even some places that have a 7 day age of the tide.
Jim, thanks for your question. We'll move to Freeport and Ryan. Hi, Ryan. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, I've seen videos and I've heard of tidal bore in other parts of the world, and it seemed like in Maine, with all the rivers we have and all the inlets and the massive tide, that we might have tidal bore here. Do you know if there are in Maine or in, you know, the Bay of Fundy or anywhere in the Northwest Atlantic?
Ryan, thank you so much for your question. And before I have you answer whether there are tidal bore here in Maine, I want you to tell us, Jonathan, what is a tidal bore, B-O-R-E?
A tidal bore is when the tide goes up a river in the form of a wave or a solid wall of water. And actually, there are a lot more of them around the world than most of us realize, certainly more than I realized when I started this research. There's about 100 and counting. And there aren't any bores that I know of in Maine, but there are five of them up in the Bay of Fundy. And there's one in India. There's one on the Amazon up in Alaska. And the largest one in the world is on the Chentong River in China, where I visited. It's just south of Shanghai, and it gets up to 25 feet tall, and it comes in on every tide twice a day, and it's done that for over 2,500 years. And there's, as you can imagine, there's quite a long history of cultural, spiritual, poetic, scientific history around this bore.
So you've seen this. What does it look like if one is standing? You're standing on the banks of a river that is basically dry, and then all of a sudden, what do you hear and what do you see?
Yeah, it is an amazing phenomenon. Physicists liken a tidal bore to a sonic boom traveling upriver, or it's like the end crack of a whip. It's a huge transformation of energy that moves from one condition to another in a matter of seconds. So in this case, I was in China and a number of times actually, and I went down into the river and I timed actually the bore and to figure out how long I had to stand down there and watch it and how close I could get before I had to scramble up the jetty and get out of its way. So it's, you know, like I said, we're used to watching on the coast the tide come up in a little over 6 hours. Well, with a tidal bore, the tide comes in about 6 seconds. It's low tide in one place, and when this wave passes, it's high tide.
And throughout history, many people have been caught up in it and killed.
Absolutely. In fact, still today, people drown because of the Chentong tidal bore, in the tidal bore. And in my book, I spent some time with a man who had just lost his son, and it was really tragic. But he wanted to share the experience because he wanted people to understand how dangerous the bore was. And every year it jumps the jetty and floods acres and acres of farmland. And as I said, people drown.
Mm. Ryan, thanks for your call. We have a question, an email from Evan. About 8 or 9 years ago during low tide, there was something like a mini tsunami that came up and caused a lot of damage. It affected areas from Cundy's Harbor to Booth Bay. What could have caused this?
Well, I've heard about that, and I honestly don't know for sure. But you know, the interesting thing about the tide is that NOAA does, of course, it creates tide charts, and we live by those tide charts. But there are so many factors that can mess with that, can change it, and we know that weather changes it. You know, big storms with low pressure can make the tide higher. Storm surge, we call those. Wind can drive a tide in faster and make it higher, or the opposite. So there are a lot of meteorological factors that mess with it, as well as other phenomena like, you know, seismic activity can mess with the tide and sea level. So I don't know the specific answer to that experience, but I do know that there are things that can mess with the tide and can change what is predicted.
All right, we'll go up to Sebago and James. Hi, James. Go ahead.
Hi. I have visited the power station experimental in the Bay of Fundy and was quite impressed with it. But it occurred to me that there's an alternative way of generating power from the rise and fall of the tide. If a decommissioned cruise ship, an old cruise ship, were to be stationed in where there's not a great deal of current, but there is a reasonable rise and fall, if it were attached by one or perhaps four shafts to the bottom of the seabed, and as the cruise ship rose and fell, it would, by a kind of ratchet mechanism, it can be meant to turn turbines and generate power that way.
Interesting. Has that been explored, as far as you know, or something similar?
That's why I'm calling in.
No, I'm asking Jonathan. Sorry.
No, that's a great example, and I do know that kind of device or system is being explored along with lots of others. I mean, we don't have a solution for this yet. There's a lot of people doing a lot of different kinds of experiments, and there are all kinds of different sizes of these devices. There are some that are anchored to the bottom, some that are not, some that float on the surface and drop propellers down underneath the surface, hydraulic systems like you're talking about, some that fly through the current like kites. There's a lot of experimentation going on, and I think we've got a long ways to go, and we may end up not with one solution, but several. And maybe what you're talking about may be viable in the future.
One of the advantages of the thought that I had is that it would not cause any danger to the sea fish or whales and so on, because the motion would be so slow, there's no propeller involved.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. One possible downside of that would be just that you've got a large object on the surface, which could impede navigation or traditional uses on the water, because that is also a sensitivity.
James, thanks so much for your call. Moving on, I want to go to now on email. I'm 62 years old. I've grown up on the coast of mid-coast Maine. I've noticed that often, right when the tide is turning, there will be a series of waves. No one I know has ever observed this, even my daughter, who is a doctor in marine ecology, and her committees. Have you noticed that? And do you know what causes it?
I haven't noticed it. And so I can't even speculate its cause. I mean, it's a great thing. And I have utmost respect for the things that we witness. In fact, a lot of people here in Maine probably have witnessed all kinds of really interesting phenomenon regarding the tide. So I wouldn't discount any of it, but I haven't heard of it, and I don't have an answer for that.
Another email from Carolyn. I live on East Penobscot Bay, about 20 feet from the water. Will I need to eventually raise my house on stilts? That's the big question, isn't it?
It is, and I think it depends on what your sea level is for your house. So you could be 20 feet from the water, but you could also be 30 feet high, which would be a good thing. But, you know, sea level is going to change the tides. It's going to change the way we live on the coast. That's inevitable. But, the experience of sea level and change tides will be different everywhere. And it's, you know, in some places may see less tides and other places might see larger tides. And, of course, sea level itself is a phenomenon that happens, gradually over time, geological time, for example. Like 19 million years ago, sea level was 75 feet higher than it is today. And 14,000 years ago, when most of the seawater was locked up in ice, sea level was 450 feet lower than it is today. So it's always changing. What's different today is because of global climate change, that process is exacerbated, and we're seeing it happening faster than it normally would.
We're speaking with Jonathan White. His new book is Tides, the Science and Spirit of the Ocean. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We're going to take one more quick break.
Do the baby boomers owe millennials a clean planet, or is it every generation for itself? Climate One is changing the conversation on energy, economy, and the environment. Join host Greg Dalton for the next Climate One.
Stay with us this afternoon for Climate One, upcoming at 2 p.m. And tonight at 8 p.m. on Maine Public Television, it's Big Pacific, the first episode of a series called Mysterious. Explore the mysterious Pacific Ocean, where the depths are just beginning to be explored, and there are many unanswered questions that we yearn to learn, but the ocean doesn't give up its secrets willingly. That's on Maine Public Television tonight at 8 p.m. Big Pacific.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the programming Understanding Tides. Joining me today, Jonathan White, a writer, conservationist, sailor, and educator. He is the author of Talking on the Water, Conversations About Nature and Creativity. And his new book is Tides, the Science and Spirit of the Ocean. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Jonathan, before we go back to the calls, I have to ask you about your experience in the Arctic, perhaps the most remote of all the remote places you traveled for this book.
Yes, maybe. I went up there because I learned that it also has the highest tide in the world, that 54 feet, 6 inches record that it shares with the Bay of Fundy. And I went up there and I learned that during just the right ice conditions and tide conditions, they chop a hole in the 3-foot thick ice and go underneath the ice during a low tide when there's cavities underneath the ice, and they hunt for fresh blue mussels during the winter. And I was invited by a elder there to join him, and it took 2 years to get just the right conditions. And I went up there, and indeed, I went out with Lucas Sinopoluk, and we chopped a hole in the ice, and he went down before me to check it out and finally invited me down, and I went down. And so I'm in minus 17 degree.
So you're in an ice cave under the water?
No, not under the water. I'm in an ice cave, but I'm in a hollow region underneath the ice when the tide has gone out.
I see.
Remember, this is very large tide, and the ice is crumpled around the intertidal zone. And so they chop a hole and they go underneath the ice. So it's an ice cave. But it looks like an intertidal zone, just like you would see one out here, except that you're in an ice cave. There's ice above your head.
Wow.
And it's dark, and it's womb-like because it's warm. It's like plus 40 degrees. And just to gather fresh blue mussels. And it was an otherworldly experience.
Wow. We have a Facebook question from Elaine. Is Mr. White familiar with the largest tsunami ever recorded in Lituya, Alaska in 1958? Quite a story.
Yes, I am. I've spent some time up in that area. It is an extraordinary story. Yes. One of the interesting things about that tsunami is there were boats in the harbor when that tsunami hit. And some of those boats were actually lifted up out of the harbor and taken out to sea. And, of course, some of them were taken up into the woods and the mountains. And there are records now of geological records that wave washed up 1,000 feet high up on the mountains there.
Mm. We'll go to Bruce calling from Harpswell. Hi, Bruce. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm very glad that you just talked about tsunamis, because the previous an earlier caller who asked what was the huge tide that occurred at low tide in Booth Bay Harbor in 2008, and it's a tsunami. It's what called a meteo tsunami, or one that's caused by atmospheric or meteorological reasons, and they're caused by an area of extremely low pressure, so the surrounding normal pressure pushes the ocean up, and it can reach very high level, 18 feet above normal ocean level, and it travels with the speed of the air, because that's the speed that the low pressure is forming. And Booth Bay was extraordinarily lucky, first that it hit at low tide, and secondly that it was just a small one or a medium-sized one.
Bruce, thanks for your call.
Thank you very much. That's fascinating. I'm looking forward to learning more about that.
Great. Is this similar to, I lived for 2 years in Monterey, California, and we would cover as journalists from time to time a ghost wave taking a fisherman off a rock. Is that related to this? Is that similar?
Honestly, probably not, because what you're probably talking about is a rogue wave, which is a surface wave. It's a really different phenomenon than a tide. A tsunami, by the way, we often call tsunamis a tide wave, but it's actually has nothing to do with the tide. It's a seismic generated thing, or as the last caller said, it could be generated by an extreme weather conditions. But, we're familiar with a storm surge like Sandy and Katrina. We're both large storm surge. And as the last caller said, you know, these can be huge. Like I think Katrina, the storm surge was over 10 feet. Huge kind of difference there. And that's caused by a very, very low pressure system that's allowing the ocean to rise like a dish underneath the storm. And then it travels with the storm. And that plus tide ends up with these huge flooding kind of conditions.
We'll go to Jim calling from Norway. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Are you saying Jim?
J-I-M? Yes, yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm from Newry. Anyway, I worked under the Tidewater Motel about 15 years ago, building a turbine, an experimental one, with a helical turbine blade similar to the ones that Chris Sauer uses up at in the Bay of Fundy. I did supply a few blades to Chris on his earlier turbines. Like I said, this is a long time ago. And they did generate electricity, but it was at the early stages of experimentation. Later on, we built one on Shelter Island off the end of Long Island, New York, and that generated power for a couple of weeks. We have good documentation on that. The tides down there, of course, are much less than up here in Maine, but they both produce power. And like I said, it was about 10 to 15 years ago we did this. So just thought your readers would be, or your listeners would be interested in that. And I also like to go up to Truro, Nova Scotia. Truro is where the tidal bore happens at the end of the Bay of Fundy. And they had a motel up there called the Tidal Bore Motel, but I don't think it's still in operation.
Yeah, that's a great story. I think one of the interesting things about tide energy is that, you know, we tend to think about it as something that's fairly new, and it's actually got a long history. There were tide mills all over Europe and all over our East Coast here in the 1600s, all the way through the mid 1800s. And they were used to generate power to as sawmills and to make paper, to of course grind wheat. And
so the same way a river mill was used.
Exactly, very much like that. But they were set on these. You know, one of the things, of course, that's important for a tide mill is that it's on a bay with a large tide. So you have a lot of those in Maine and up in Nova Scotia and all around the northern part of Europe, the UK and France and not Germany, but down in the Portugal area in Spain. So there were thousands of them, actually, during this period of time. And John F. Kennedy looked into this, and he at Passamaquoddy, he was very interested in doing this. And so there have been a lot of attempts and a lot of interesting research, and there have been times that has been more conducive for doing it and times that haven't. And you asked earlier, why is it so difficult to get this underway? And a part of the problem is that the United States doesn't have a unified policy that supports this. You know, we kind of have to make it up ourselves. And Scotland has a very strong policy, as does Germany and Spain. So that's one of the things, one of our challenges is getting money to develop these things.
Thanks, Jim, for your call. We're going from Jim to James on Vinyl Haven. Hi, James. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I'm looking forward to reading your book. I have a comment and a question. Not only did I see the energy generating turbine that was under the Tidewater Motel, but also on that same site, there are the remnants of the turbines that were used to polish granite back in the 19th century. So they were using it here on Vinyl Haven, using the tidal flow out of Carver's Pond into the harbor back then. But here's my question, different question. Is there any influence that the tidal bulge has on the prevailing wind at slack tide? Sometimes it seems as though the wind diminishes as the tide slackens, and I just wonder about that.
That is a great question. That's one of those ones that is much like a previous caller where, you know, there's a phenomenon that happens that's not necessarily part of the science. But it's definitely observed. I have seen that as a sailor I know that at slack water, often not only does the wind die, but sometimes it'll change direction. And but I, in all my studies, I never came across a scientific reason for that.
Yeah, it seems like maybe a bellows effect, but that's the only thing I could think of.
Yeah, or some kind of a relationship with barometric pressure. It's again, it's observed, and I put a lot of stake in that, but no science that I've come across on it.
James, thanks for your question.
You.
Yeah, we're going to move on to Gray and Antonio. Hi, Gray. Hi, Antonio. Go ahead.
Oh, hello. Thank you for having me on the show. This question to Mr. White is, during your research, I was wondering if you came across how the moon and the sun alignment would influence the water level, the swelling or non-swelling of the water in the brain of a person, and how that would influence behavior. I'm coming at this from hearing over the years that such a story, such as werewolf stories and other stories that usually have the full moon.
Right. Great question, Antonio. I'm going to give Jonathan a chance to answer. Go ahead.
Yes. So there are lots of stories, anecdotal stories about this kind of thing, too, in terms of maternity wards being very busy in the full moon. And not a lot of science yet to back these things up. For example, when the moon is overhead, our bodies change in weight by about the weight of a drop of sweat. It is, you know, our bodies are 75% water, so you'd think that there would be a tide in them. And in fact, there is, but it's so very, very small. In fact, there's a tide in our morning cup of coffee, but it's hard to measure it. It falls into this area of study called chronobiology, which is about time and life and rhythms, biological rhythms. And we know that there are many, many, many creatures in the intertidal zone that live coastally or even offshore that are influenced by tidal and lunar rhythms. And for human beings, not so much so. We're so focused on a solar life. But there's a lot of research that indicates that there are vestiges of tidal rhythms and lunar rhythms within the humans, within any living being on Earth. And I think over the next 50 years, we're going to learn a lot about that.
All right. Antonio, thanks for your question. Marita, we are almost out of time. If you have a very quick comment or question, that would be great. Marita, are you there?
Oh, hello. I'm here. I didn't hear my name. Thank you so much. I do. Just somewhat relevant, we have a performance coming up in Portland called Tides, Les Mariés. It's a celebration of West African dance and drumming. It's presented by the New Moon Ensemble, and it's at Mayo Street Arts on Thursday, July 13th.
Great, Marita. I'm going to ask you to go to the Maine Calling Facebook page and put some more information because we use that as a resource. We also have information about Jonathan White's upcoming events. This week, you're in several places.
Yes, I arrived from the West Coast last night, and I'll be tonight at Wells Lot Home. And then tomorrow night, June 22nd, I'll be at Camden Public Library.
All right. And there are three more that I've got on our Facebook page. So go to facebook.com/maincalling if you'd like to learn more about seeing Jonathan White speak about tides. Thank you so much. Jonathan White, a writer, conservationist, sailor, and educator. He is the former president of the Resource Institute and author of Tides, the Science and Spirit of the Ocean. George Thomas ran the board today. Dan Plummer answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.net. Today's show will be rebroadcast at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a conversation about the role of technology in Maine's schools. We'll get an update on the Laptop for Students program and discuss what the future might hold for the initiative. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.